Ukraine's president says the Russian missile strikes have left millions of households without power in his country. Turkey's president vows to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid intensified Turkish attacks on Kurdish militants in the Arab country. And Iran beats Wales 2-0 to keep its World Cup campaign alive, prompting celebrations across the country. Hello everyone, a very warm welcome to World News. Now our top story, the Ukrainian president says over 6 million households in the country have been affected by power cuts amid Russia's missile onslaught. Vladimir Zelensky says blackouts are continuing in the capital, Kiev, and most other regions, including Odessa, Lviv, and Dnipro. He says, however, that the number of affected households has dropped by half since Wednesday. Russia has been targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure in recent weeks. As winter approaches, this has stoked fears of a health crisis and further exodus from the war-torn country. Moscow says it seeks to push Ukraine to negotiate, but Kiev says attacks on infrastructure and are intended, that is, to harm civilians, which makes them a war crime. NATO's chief says it's up to Germany to decide if it wants to supply Patriot anti-aircraft missile systems to Ukraine following a request by Poland.
We have also provided significant air defense systems to Ukraine, including with modern systems. Germany has provided modern air defense systems to Ukraine, and I will, at the foreign ministerial meeting next week, urge allies to further step up the support, not least with air defense to Ukraine. But specific decisions on specific capabilities, that remains national decisions.
Jens Stoltenberg was referring to talks between NATO members Germany and Poland over the air defense system. Berlin offered to deploy the U.S.-made system in Poland after a stray missile hit a Polish village near the Ukrainian border last week, leaving two Polish citizens dead. But Warsaw told Germany to ship the system to Ukraine to help it fight Russia. Now on Thursday, German officials said the Patriot units were intended for use in NATO territory only. Berlin further insists that any use of the weapons outside of this area will need prior discussions with NATO allies. Germany has already cautioned that NATO should not become participant to the Ukraine conflict while trying to strengthen Kiev's defenses. The Turkish president has vowed to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid intensified Turkish attacks on Kurdish militants in the Arab country. Recep Tayyip Erdogan says Ankara will complete that zone as soon as possible. He has long sought to achieve this, which has been repeatedly decried by the Syrian government. His remarks came as a UK-based monitoring group affiliated with the Syrian opposition said that Turkey carried out new raids on northeastern province of Hasaka earlier in the day. Turkey started hitting areas in northeastern Syria about 2 years ago, but it intensified its strikes last week when an explosion in Istanbul left 6 people killed. Ankara has blamed the bombing on Kurdish militant groups based out of Iraq and Syria. They've all denied the allegations. Damascus has called Turkey's airstrikes a breach of both international law and Syrian sovereignty. Independent political analyst Mohammed Hassan Dable says that Turkey's attacks on Syria are a serious threat to peace and stability in the region.
This is really a serious concern for the region in terms of peace and stability. As you know, the ethnic spillover, the effect of this war will have the consequences could not be imagined. It could lead to an all-out war. It could even involve Iran to take actions in support of the Syrians. They are taking advantage at the moment of the current situation where Russia, that had a lot of influence over in Syria, is at the moment involved in the Ukraine war, and Turkey is taking advantage of that, trying to expand its influence in the northern the northern Syrian areas.
Rights groups accuse the European Union of breaking international law by attempting to prevent refugees from seeking asylum in the 27-nation bloc. It's also claimed EU leaders are discriminating against refugees if they do not originate from Ukraine. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
EU Home Affairs ministers held an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope.
We need to protect our external borders, and we need to return those who do not qualify for asylum and to be under the legal umbrella of the European Union.
Rights groups say this approach is scandalous, considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the European, to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated.
For the EU, all refugees except from Ukraine are illegal migrants, and yet most of them come from Afghanistan and Syria, countries that are victims of imperialist interventions and wars that the West caused.
It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Soaring inflation and worsening cost of living crisis in the UK is triggering more and more industrial action across different sectors. This time, university staff, more than 70,000 of them, are walking off the job in what's been billed as the biggest strike in the history of UK's higher education. Saeed Puraza reports.
150 universities are involved in 3 days of industrial action, affecting up to 2.5 million students. Action these students support.
If they're not paid properly, they can't teach properly, and therefore we can't learn properly, and then we're not getting what we're paying for in the first place.
Teaching conditions are learning conditions, and as long as our teachers aren't paid well, they can't teach well.
We think it's really important that teachers get a fair pay, and it's important for our learning conditions as well, so we stand in solidarity with our teachers.
The list of grievances is long. Trade unions say staff pay and pensions have declined by 25 and 35% respectively since 2009, in real terms, while workloads have increased. Lecturers earn an average of $55,000 a year. Academics are increasingly being offered short-term contracts, meaning many have to reapply for their jobs every few months.
People who are having to work more than one job in order to stay alive because the jobs that they get are casualized, their contracts are not secured, and the salaries they get for each job they do isn't sufficient to keep them alive. We've had stories up and down the country of people who, for example, have to live in a tent because they can't afford to pay the rent on a lecturer's salary because they're casualized.
You can't plan where you're going to live, you can't plan having a family, you never know exactly how long you're going to be employed, so you can't plan anything.
The average undergraduate degree costs around $35,000 in tuition fees. That's excluding books, travel, and accommodation. Students from outside the UK pay double or more.
If you're a teacher, one of your tasks is to steer your pupils into a job, to tell them that at the end of the day, education pays off, that it has societal value. But the reality is that some of the brightest minds in Britain are struggling to make a living.
Compare that with the average vice chancellor's pay, which is 6.5 times greater than the average staff member's. This is the latest in a wave of escalating industrial action taking place across the UK. Workers in several other sectors, such as the postal service, transportation, and health, also walking out for similar reason. Negotiations between university staff and management are ongoing. Meanwhile, frustration among academics is growing that universities are putting profit before people. Saeed Purza, London.
And now nurses in Britain are also planning a strike for next month as their demands for a pay increase have been turned down by the government. And the strike by the Royal College of Nursing Union will be the first in its 106-year history. Nurses from England, Wales, and Northern Ireland will be walking off the job December 15th and the 20th. They're demanding a pay rise that will help them through the cost of living crisis plaguing UK families. This is how British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak reacted to their demands.
What the unions are asking for, I think, is a 19% pay rise. And I think most people watching will recognise that that's obviously unaffordable. And that's why I'm pleased that the Health Secretary is sitting down, talking to the union, and hopefully we can find a way through this.
Sunak acknowledged a difficult situation the healthcare workers and everyone else in the UK are going through as a result of unprecedented inflation. He stressed his plans outlined last week will rein in soaring prices and calm the economy. Planned strikes by the nurses will be the latest in a series of walkouts by tens of thousands of other union workers in various sectors. They're all struggling to get by as the UK grapples with 40-year high inflation of over 11%. Lembito Peake is a former member of the British Parliament. He tells us the buck stops at Downing Street when it comes to the UK's economic woes.
Pretty much the whole of the public sector is angry with the government right now because it's the government that's messed up. We're picking up the pieces from a government-sponsored recession, a government-sponsored interest rate increase, a government-sponsored inflation rate increase. There's no point in them blaming anybody else. Putin doesn't run the British economy. Putin doesn't make the decisions about where we buy our energy from. So that would be the simple solution. But in practice, the government can't do that, because if they do this, then the nurses will get their money, but everybody else will say, well, what about us? And then we head to a general strike. What I conclude from this situation is there is currently no way out for the government except to fix the economy. So they have to do something to bring inflation down and to bring productivity up and also interest rates down. There's one thing they can do there. They can abandon the energy policies they've got. They can start using the gas, which is under the feet of myself and Amin and everybody else in the UK. Perhaps even consider increasing oil and even talk about coal. Because at the moment, if they want to insist on having a green environmental agenda, then we're probably going to have a red government after the next general election.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has testified at a public inquiry to defend his use of emergency powers to end a truckers-led protest earlier in the year. Trudeau used wartime measures to clear out protests, which disrupted trade in Ottawa and brought the city to a standstill. The Freedom Convoy, as it was called, was angry at the government-mandated COVID vaccines. Trudeau invoked the Emergencies Act after the second week of the street-jamming protests. Police eventually had to tow the big rigs out of Ottawa and arrested some 200 protesters. Trudeau's address wraps up about 6 weeks of hearings at the Public Order Emergency Commission following backlash he received for how he dealt with the protests. And earlier in our news review program, we discussed the protests and the Canadian government's response to them.
Joining us on this edition of the news review, we have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich, who is joining us from Belgrade. And we also have Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Bosnich in Belgrade. First of all, I want to get your overall opinion of how events have transpired. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is now set in a place where he has to testify to a public inquiry about his decision.
Well, unfortunately, the Canadian system is not set up to allow people to hold the political elite to any kind of accountability. When you've got a majority in a parliamentary system like the English or Canadian parliamentary system, you have an effective dictatorship. Until the next election, if you control a majority in the House, you can do literally whatever you want. You can actually suspend the Constitution, which is what what has been done by Trudeau's government, exactly like his own father did in 1970. So in my own case, I've lived through two Trudeau regimes in two cases in which they've both imposed martial law without any threat whatsoever of war. That's what the reality is, unfortunately, in Canada today, and that's exactly what it's been in Canada for more than 50 years.
Well, Robert Fantina is with us from Kitchener, Ontario. Do you agree with what our guest, John Bozich, just said?
Well, I certainly agree in principle that the invocation of this act was an extreme measure. This emergency act is designed for just that, national emergencies, threats to the survival of the government. It sets a dangerous precedent when the prime minister invokes that act in order to quell a protest in Ottawa. Certainly the protest was disruptive to trade, to the businesses, but to take such an extreme measure seems to be really unnecessary. The local police, which of course Trudeau denies this, say that they had a plan, that they were, everything was under control, and they were going to begin moving the truckers out and ending the disruption, but they were not given the opportunity to do that when Trudeau decided to invoke this act. Again, it sets a dangerous precedent, I think, for him and future Canadian governments.
Iran has defeated Wales 2-0 in the World Cup in Qatar to keep alive its hopes of advancing to the knockout round. Ruzbe Cheshmi and Ramin Rezaian scored both Iran's goals in injury time to send the fans into ecstasy. Iran now has 3 points in Group B of the games and will face the U.S. in a make-or-break decider on Tuesday. Victory prompted jubilant scenes and celebrations across Iran. In a congratulatory message, President Ebrahim Raisi thanked the national team and vowed to continue to support them. And that's a wrap for your latest. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
New estimates suggest that global carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuel has hit a record high. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Common Dreams wrote, "Rapid and drastic cuts to global greenhouse gas emissions are necessary to curb warming and prevent the most dire climate scenarios from becoming reality." But a new study released recently by the Global Carbon Project finds no sign of the decrease that is urgently needed, as emissions remain at record levels this year, with fossil fuel giants and governments plowing ahead with new extraction efforts that could push critical climate targets out of reach. Scientists with Global Carbon Project estimate that total CO2 emissions will reach 40.6 billion tons this year, driven by rising pollution from fossil fuels, and will likely continue to rise in 2023 without bold action from policymakers worldwide. If current emission levels persist, there is now a 50% chance that global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius will be exceeded in 9 years. The researchers note, adding, projected emissions from coal and oil are above their 2021 levels, with oil being the largest contributor to total emissions growth. The report finds the 2022 picture among major emitters is mixed. Emissions are projected to fall in China and the EU, an increase in US, India, with 1.7% rise in the rest of the world combined. Professor Pierre of Exeter Global Systems Institute, the lead author of the new study, lamented in a statement that we see yet another rise in global fossil CO2 emissions in 2022 when we need a rapid decline. He said, there are some positive signs pointing to the slowing growth of fossil fuel emissions over the long term, but leaders meeting at COP27 will have to take meaningful action if they are to have any chance of limiting global warming close to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Climate campaigners warn the opportunity is at risk of being squandered as big oil lobbies swarm the conference and gas producers use the event to push their dirty energy source as a transition fuel. Professor Corinne Lockere of University of East Anglia, a co-author of the Global Carbon Project study, said that if governments respond to worsening climate chaos by turbocharging clean energy investments and planting, not cutting trees, global emissions could rapidly start to fall. We are at a turning point and must not allow world events to distract us from the urgent and sustained need to cut our emissions to stabilize the global climate and reduce cascading risks, Lo Carrere warned. Allowing planetary heating to exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by the end of the century would spell disaster for large swathes of the planet, as trends already seen around the world, from increasingly extreme weather events to species extinctions to rapidly melting sea ice, would accelerate, potentially locking in irreversible climate damage. Professor Mark Maslin of University College London told The Guardian that the Global Carbon Project study is deeply depressing. It sends a clear message to the leaders at COP27. The world needs to have significant cuts in global emissions 2023 if we are to have any chance to keep climate change to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Time had an eye on this issue, writing, the world's burning of coal, oil, and natural gas this year is putting 1% more heating trapping carbon dioxide in the air than last year. Bad news for the fight against climate change, but with an odd twist, according to scientists who track emissions. While global carbon pollution is still increasing, it isn't increasing at as fast a rate as 10 or 15 years ago. But overall, scientists said this is bad news because it is pushing Earth closer to hitting and then passing the globally adopted threshold of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius since pre-industrial times. In 2022, the world is on track to put 36.6 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide in the air from energy and cement use, the study calculated. That's the weight of the Great Pyramid of Giza in carbon dioxide spewed every 75 minutes. In addition to the United States seeing emissions go up, India had a 6% increase in 2022, while Europe had an 0.8% drop. The rest of the world average 1.7% carbon pollution jump. Pollution from coal jumped 1% from last year. For oil, it went up 2%, and for natural gas, it went down 0.2%, the report said. About 40% of the carbon dioxide comes from burning coal, 33% from oil, and 22% from natural gas. Carbon emissions from fossil fuels plunged 5.3% in 2020, but rebounded 5.6% last year, spurred by some countries, and now have completely erased the pandemic drop and are back on a slowly rising trend. The team also looks at overall emissions, including the effects of land use. When land use is factored in, emissions are flat, not rising slightly.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Let us contemplate upon what the leader of the pious and the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, has said about the vicissitudes of life. Opportunity passes away like the cloud moving in the sky. Therefore, make use of good opportunities.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, perfection. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z program. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. Now, in today's lesson, we're talking about the act of perfection. Although the meaning of perfection is clear and needs no definition, we are forced to provide an explanation in this regard so that mistakes will not be made in certain instances. Also, so that we can make it clear for what kind of perfection we are talking about. Without doubt, perfection is an existential trait with which a being is endowed. But when we compare an existential matter with various things, we find that there is perfection as compared to some. While as compared to others, there is no perfection. Rather, it might occasionally lead to deficiency and decline of its existential value. Likewise, some others principally do not have the talent to possess some forms of perfection. For instance, becoming sweet is a sign of perfection for some fruits, such as pears and honeydew. And on the contrary, being sour or having other flavors might be a sign of perfection for some other fruits. It's not a must that perfection goes one way. Perfection could go both ways. One thing can be perfect by being black, and the other will be perfect by being white. A human being can be perfect by running, and another one by walking. A human being can be perfect by, you know, sleeping well, and another one will be perfect by waking up. So perfection doesn't go one way. And we need to look at perfection as a sign of such of completeness and closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. In today's lesson, we're talking about perfection. The aspect of perfection is an aspect that should be checked on in a wider manner, and Islamically, it does have a very wide meaning, and it does have so many angles for us to look at it. An example of perfection is that acquirement of science and knowledge is perfection for man, while stones and wood are not qualified to possess it. Whenever a human being runs towards knowledge to study more, to understand whether it's science, whether it's any other type of knowledge, it means that this particular human being is driving himself towards perfection. But you see, the same learning and studying and the knowledge that he's searching for perfection is not the case with the mountains and the trees. The trees and the mountains do not need to study to be perfect. They just need enough water. They just need enough sun and a good weather in order for them to be perfect, but not knowledge. So perfection is not a one-way thing. It can be a two-way thing compared to the situation you are in, to the geographical position that you are in. So the secret behind the matter is that each being is accorded a specific substantial limit and boundary. Going beyond this boundary will turn being into another form, which is, by essence, inconsistent with it. Substantial changes might be coupled with a change in the molecular structure, increase of decrease of their atoms, elemental or inner changes in the terms and transmutation of matter into energy, or even vice versa. So perfection is something that we should look at very closely and see how perfect do we want to be, which is the type of perfection that will please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and will make us closer to Him. And that way we can have a perfect perfection. Thank you so much for listening to this show. Until next show, inshallah, next episode, we will meet together. Fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
It's always a tricky task to remember people's names at a party, but not in this particular gathering in Tokyo, where all the guests had the exact same name, Hirokazu Tanaka. 178 Hirokazu Tanakas came together on Saturday to set a new namesake gathering world record. Their ages spanned from 3 years old to 80. The Guinness World Record for the largest gathering of people with the same first and last name previously belonged to Martha Stewart. 164 people with that name came together in New York in 2005. In the Tanaka's gathering, every man was assigned an alias inspired by their hobbies, occupation, or favorite foods to tell them apart from others. One nicknamed by his birthplace says, "It's strange to meet so many people with the same name." Obviously.
It's a strange feeling to know that there are nearly 200 people with the same name. To be honest, I'd presume there are more popular names out there like Suzuki and Sato. This achievement is really because of the efforts of our organizer.
The man who organized this gathering is a 53-year-old Hirokazu Tanaka who has worked for years to make this happen. He says his quest began in 1994 when he stumbled upon news about a baseball prodigy with the same name. After that, he began tirelessly scouring the nation for his namesakes. He then founded the Hirokazu Tanaka campaign that brought the men together and created a strange friendship among them.
Iran is famous for its hand-knotted carpets and ancient art which have been loved for centuries and are never going out of style despite changing tastes and increased competition from Asia. Striking geometric shapes that recall 20th century abstract art are what we expect to see in handmade Iranian rugs. But weavers and exporters have been forced to redesign a tradition dating back more than 2,000 years due to numerous problems. Carpet exporter Ahad Azimzadeh says, however, that a revolution is underway. Iranian rugs are known for dense, curving floral designs in rich colors. They were put on display in a recent exhibition that featured a rug with small squares of hypnotic diagonal blue and white lines and another depicting diamond and other patterns in gold silk. Some countries have overtaken Iran in the global market, but many say modern carpets will never replace the traditional ones which are deep-rooted in Iranian culture.
Thousands of baby turtles have been released into Peru's Amazon basin in an attempt to preserve the rainforest ecosystem. More than 6,000 hatchlings of three endangered species of turtles have been released into lakes and lagoons in Peru to help them repopulate. To make this happen, wildlife officials collected the eggs from their natural habitat and transferred them to artificial beaches until they hatched. The river turtles are considered vulnerable because for many years they have been killed for human consumption or kept as pets. Scientists are currently trying to conserve the Amazon to avoid catastrophic climate change, and Peru has the second largest share of the rainforest after Brazil. Another world record news. This time it has been set in Switzerland. A Swiss railway company has run the world's longest passenger train with a trip on one of the most spectacular tracks through the Alps. To celebrate its 175th anniversary, Switzerland's rail industry launched the world's longest ever passenger train, measuring around 2 kilometers. The electric train took almost an hour to cover around 25 kilometers over the UNESCO World Heritage Albula line in eastern Switzerland. The Albula line is famous for its endless swooping curves and steep descents. Rail enthusiasts lined the valley to watch the train's 100 cars snake through the Alps. Belgium and the Netherlands were the previous record holders for the world's longest passenger train. They used standard railway through the flat landscapes.
After repeated failed attempts, NASA has eventually launched this moon rocket on its debut flight. NASA's next-generation moon rocket blasted off from Florida, marking the start of the space agency's new program dubbed Artemis. An uncrewed Orion spaceship is fixed to the top of the 32-story tall Space Launch System rocket. It will be separated for a 25-day voyage around the moon and back without astronauts aboard. It was the third time after two previous launch attempts were cancelled for technical reasons. If the mission succeeds, a crewed Artemis II will orbit around the moon but not land on the surface in 2024. The third Artemis mission, scheduled for 2025, will be the first to put astronauts on the moon since Apollo's mission about 5 decades ago.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Iran has hosted an international student scientific contest dubbed Noor or Light. The annual event seeks to promote science among children and scout for child prodigies. Yusuf Jalali has the story.
They have only 1 minute to present a scientific idea in their homemade clips. Over 1,300 teenage science enthusiasts from 19 countries participated in Iran's Noor competition, a scientific contest for school students. The fifth edition of the event was themed with optical illusion and mathematical modeling. The top 100 videos were awarded during this closing ceremony in Tehran.
My work is titled The Bouncing Ball. We painted a long oval and a shadow under it. When we film it from a certain angle, it takes the shape of a levitating ball.
Our work is about an optical illusion. We created a set of conjoining cylinders that appeared to change shape in the mirror. The idea was first created by a Japanese engineer in 2016.
The most creative videos win the prize. They should be both educational and mind-blowing, like this floating Rubik's Cube, which appears to be levitating, but then turns out to be just an origami work.
We have two levels of the competition. One is the kind of general competition for the crowd, and many students can contribute on that, in that. And we have other level, which is for elites. And in that level, we have more sophisticated competition between elite.
Organizers say participants in Noor contests are not supposed to make breakthroughs. The main goal, they say, is to engage them in science and let them experience the excitement of scientific experiments.
Try to make these teenagers learn how they can think about science for the welfare of human beings and how they can apply it for them.
Mustafa Science and Technology Foundation is the organizer of this scientific event. The foundation also holds the biennial Mustafa Prize, which awards cash prizes to top scientists from across the Muslim world, whose accomplishments contribute to the welfare of human beings.
Mustafa Science and Technology Foundation, as the organizer of Noor competition, says prodigies are everywhere. They just need to be discovered. It says this contest is a platform that's specially designed to scout for teenage minds and give them a chance to shine. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Chinese aerobatic teams have been performing jaw-dropping stunts to mark the 73rd anniversary of the People's Liberation Army Air Force. Pilots wowed the audience with their complicated maneuvers, such as swooping close to the ground, making loops and rolls. Aerobatic teams use red, yellow and blue smoke trails representing the flag of the Chinese Air Force. The Hongying aerobatic team, also known as the Red Eagle, is made up of 10 JL-8 trainer planes and 20 pilots from the Air Force Aviation University. The performance was part of China's International Aviation and Aerospace Exhibition held in southern China. The exhibit typically draws thousands of participants in the field of aviation from countries all over the world. Iran is the land of saffron, and the red gold has earned the country a fortune throughout the centuries. Now Iran's city of Torbat Haydariya has hosted a saffron photography festival as a means to introduce the lucrative product to the world. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Like gold, it is weighed in shekels, not in kilos. And that's why saffron is called the red gold, reflecting how precious it is economically. Torbat Haydariya in northeast Iran is the hub of saffron cultivation in the country, producing an average of 20 million tons of the crop each year. Now the city hosts the Festival of Saffron Photography every year to introduce Iran as the land of saffron and how these hard-working farmers produce the strategic crop.
Photographers present in this festival should use their artistry to shed light on different stages of saffron harvest all the way to the final product. Everyone knows Iranian saffron, but perhaps few know how it's produced. So this festival highlights this issue using photography.
Photography is a universal language that needs no translation, so their photos can better introduce this strategic plan to the world from unique angles.
This year, Iran exported roughly 300 tons of saffron, generating more than $350 million in income, according to the data provided by the Ministry of Agriculture. Experts believe Iran could have a much higher share of the global trade of saffron if it pays better attention to branding and marketing of the product.
Due to favorable weather conditions, Iranian saffron is unique in the world. But unfortunately, in many countries, it's smuggled in bulk and is packaged under foreign brands and then sold at higher prices. If we can brand it inside Iran, then we can export it more efficiently.
The young farm owner says his saffron is exported to Europe and the Middle East, despite the restrictions caused by U.S. sanctions on Iran. But more than the U.S. measures, he's concerned about the impact of climate change on saffron cultivation, warning of what he calls saffron immigration from his city, if authorities remain idle.
Unfortunately, saffron is gradually leaving our region and moving to western parts of Iran. This is due to changes in weather conditions and declining rainfall here. If the government helps farmers with modification of planting patterns, we can stop this disaster.
Over the past 2 years, Iran has expanded its cultivation area for saffron to 115,000 hectares, nearly 20 times more than the entire worldwide land dedicated to the crop. While the Iranian red gold is mainly cultivated in the northeastern Khorasan province, other parts of the country, including Khuzestan and Chaharmahal Bakhtiari, are also fertile for saffron farming.
For centuries, saffron has been a key word in Iran's economy, and still is today. Now, Saffron Photography Festival says many know Iran by its red gold, but through the photos shot here, they will get a glimpse of the mesmerizing saffron farms in Iran and how this amazing crop is produced. Yusuf Jalali from the saffron farms in the suburbs of Torbat Haydariya.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to analysts, the crisis of gas shortages in Europe and the possibility of citizens turning to electric heating devices will put Europe on the verge of widespread blackouts. They say next winter we will see larger regional blackouts in Europe. The risk of industrial closures, power outages, and blackouts due to gas shortages lurks among European citizens in the cold winter, which can also lead to regional tensions. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Berlin-based newspaper Welt am Sonntag writes, a German official sounded the alarm warning of serious electricity shortage in the country and across the region. Rolf Tissler, president of the German Federal Office for Civil Protection and Disaster Assistance, said, "We have to assume that there will be big blackouts in winter." Tissler said, "We have to expect blackouts in winter. By this I mean a regional and temporary interruption in the power supply," adding that the power cuts were due to both energy shortages and temporary shutdowns of the entire grid to protect the entire network. The official further added that he was referring to short-term power outages, so-called brownouts, rather than larger-scale blackouts. Tissler warned that the situation could potentially reach a critical point, urging Germans to stock on food, water, and other essential supplies. Tissler said the last couple of years have been really tough for Germans, adding that the COVID-19 pandemic served as a prime example of the unforeseen effects of a crisis. Tissler pointed out the coming years are yet to be more challenging in light of the worsening climate situation and other serious and geopolitical tensions. He said the saddest part of the news was the European Union at the confederal level denies the hardships that normal people were going to face in winter. In related news, a major German grid operator told media in early October that the country may be forced this year to cut its electricity exports to other countries in order to survive in winter. Hendrik Naumann, chief technical officer of German electricity grid operator Amprion, told the Financial Times about potentially cutting off electricity exports to other countries to avoid local shortages. Naumann said in an interview that temporarily pausing exports of electricity for hours rather than days could be a last resort to salvage the country's embattled energy crisis, which has been in the eyes of the storm since gas supplies from Russia were cut. France and Austria are the biggest importers of Germany's surplus electric power, whose energy crises could deteriorate with any switch off of German exports. Naumann said the Ukraine crisis was one of the numerous overlapping issues contributing to Europe's energy crisis, worsened by the shutdown of over half of France's 56 nuclear power plants and low water levels on main rivers delaying coal shipping. Germany's government decided in September to postpone the decommissioning of 2 out of 3 nuclear power plants in the country, saying it will keep the 2 plants running until at least April. Germany shut down 3 nuclear reactors in 2021, and shutting the remaining 3 would officially mark the end of the nuclear phase-out for domestic energy production.
In the meantime, the Russia Today Daily reports national grid operator RTE warned on Friday, November 18th, France faces a greater risk of running short on electricity in January because the availability of the country's nuclear plants will probably be lower than previously forecast. RTE, which has been issuing updates of the situation on a monthly basis, also noted that decrease in the demand for power is making a shortage next month less likely than previously expected. RT claimed the situation appears less risky in December and from the end of February, but the month of January now concentrates more risks than in the previous analysis. Grid operator Electricité de France earlier warned that repairs and maintenance on almost half of the nation's nuclear plants may turn France, which has traditionally been a power exporter, into an importer this year. France generates roughly 70% of its electricity from 56 nuclear reactors. However, it had just 31 of them online on Friday morning, November 18th. EDF has plans to restart 15 units by the end of the year, with another 10 in the first 2 months of 2023. Some other reactors will have also be stopped for scheduled maintenance. The French government has called on businesses and households to conserve energy to avoid blackouts. In the event of a possible electricity shortage, RTE will launch an eco-watch red alert 3 days in advance, demanding reduced consumption. RTE says the risk of resorting to eco-watch system appears high in January. The grid operator warns it will largely depend on climate conditions such as a potential cold snap or even a moderate one. Furthermore, France Press News Agency writes the price of electricity in Germany, France and Italy for 2023 has soared to new records due to the European energy crisis caused by the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. In Germany, the price of electricity for the year ahead reached €850 per megawatt hours in the stock market. The year ahead contract in France's bourse market passed €1,000 on Friday, November 18th. Compared to last year's price, €85 in both countries, the year-ahead contracts in both countries' markets indicate a stark rise in energy prices. Soaring energy prices coupled with runaway inflation have put the livelihood of Europeans under heavy constraints after the Europeans severed their energy ties with Russia, the main supplier of natural gas to Europe, over the Ukraine conflict triggering a dire economic crisis on the continent. The shutdown of several nuclear reactors in France due to corrosion issues has contributed to the electricity price increase as power production has dramatically decreased in the country. Also, Italy's oldest consumer association, ONC, reported on Thursday, November 17th, electricity prices in the country set an all-time record in October. Prices for electricity, which is being sold in the Apennine on the free market, have surged 329% since October last year and topped the ONC rating of the most expensive goods and services. International flights followed power tariffs with an annual increase in cost equaling 113%. Gas was the next in the ranking, with prices surging more than 96% compared to last year. Since the start of Russia's special operation in Ukraine in late February, Germany has offered substantial military support to Ukraine, sending the country billions of dollars in military aid and heavy weapons.